Welcome everyone to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 49, section 6, which is old single column, page 568. All right, I think just to get spun up for this last section here in this paper, you know, I've been going through all these different types of mortals, different ways that you can categorize mortals on their evolutionary spheres. Let me just read that last little item in the previous section there, item number 7 at the end of section 5, because it's obviously the preface to this section. You know, they're taking that one categorization that they gave us in the previous section, and they're expanding it into a whole section here for what we're going to be reading tonight. So they one of those categorizations based on, as they say, the techniques of terrestrial escape. And it says, there is fundamentally only one way in which individual human life can be initiated on the inhabited worlds. And that is through creature procreation and natural birth. But there are numerous techniques whereby man escapes his terrestrial status and gains access to the inward moving stream of paradise ascenders. The way they're setting it up is getting you to reflect on the two endpoints, basically, right, of your life on your nativity sphere, birth at one end, death at the other end. And I don't think we actually fleshed all of that out last time. You know, notice how it says there is fundamentally only one way, you know, because you may be thinking to yourself, well, what about, you know, as technology develops and we start to, you know, get involved in this process some, right? I mean, that's why they said fundamentally, right? I mean, there's no way to bring a potential ascending son of God into existence except where it's essentially procreation and natural birth, right? I mean, you may artificially bring the two gametes together or whatever, right? I mean, that, but, you know, it's still essentially procreation and natural birth. So that's why they put the fundamentally in there, just, you know, so that you didn't get off on a tangent there. And you have fundamentally only one way that you can leave your nativity sphere too: dying. Right? One way or another, you're gonna die. Doesn't matter if you fuse, you know, during your mortal life, your mortal self still dies, you know, a very spectacular death. that basic birth-death pairing is fundamental. And, all you can do is just have, you know, a little bit of technical variations upon that essential theme. But this whole bit about the techniques, you know, whereby man escapes his terrestrial status, it's not fixated on the thing we always fixate on, the actual death, right? It's what exactly happens to you subsequent to the death of your mortal self. Exactly how and where and when are you resurrected, right? And there's these basic different modes for exactly how you go forward from that death moment, and that's what we're, you know, so that's what they mean by terrestrial escape. The death part is a given, and it's the other details that are in play. All right, so why don't we just start reading a little bit here and see what they've got for us.
Section 6, terrestrial escape. All of the differing physical types and planetary series of mortals alike enjoy the ministry of thought adjusters, guardian angels, and the various orders of the messenger hosts of the Infinite Spirit. All alike are liberated from the bonds of flesh by the emancipation of natural death, and all alike go thence to the Maruntia worlds of spiritual evolution and mind progress.
So that last little bit, remember how we were talking about, with this previous section, that they called the planetary series of mortals, how that was more focused on the intellectual, spiritual issues, right? And then you had the physical types, before that, back there in section two, right? And you see him bringing up both of those, physical types and planetary series of mortals, okay? So regardless of all those things, but you notice here, spiritual evolution and mind progress, right? And this is expanding on our item number 7 in the previous one about the intellectual, spiritual, issues. See, so, they're kind of just pointing out that see naturally transitions going forward from your mortal life. Because you don't go forward physically, you go forward intellectually and spiritually. Right? I mean, technically what's ascending is a mindful self. Okay. Any body at any point is just a means to a greater end. What's ascending is that mindful self. And it's just housed in different tabernacles, as it were, different times. All right, then the other thing in there is if you're on your toes in terms of who these various designations are referring to, like messenger hosts, right? You should get a little chuckle out of that one. Where it says, mortals alike enjoy the ministry. Yeah, and then you're going, wait a minute, one of the messenger hosts is the executioners of the Ancients of Days. But I use the word enjoy. Let's see. that's kind of funny. Nonetheless, we are all ministered to, by the full spectrum, regardless of all these differences we've been talking about in previous sections. And then the other thing too is, the way they talk about death in the book is often, a challenge to overcome fear of death. Liberated from the bonds of the flesh by the emancipation, right? Sort of a poetic expansion on that more prosaic statement they make at that one point about the quote-unquote technique of death, right? Death is a technique. It is the Father's way. It's the only way, as they're just saying there, to make the transition. You have to leave behind a non-ascendable self. It has to die. And that's the only thing that thing can do. There's no magic that can make a non-ascendable self ascend. Right? It's your Maruntia self, that other self that you're currently not conscious of. That's a copy of your unconscious mind, basically, your superconscious mind. Right? That's what ascends, not the mindful self that's conscious right now. It's a non-ascendable self. It's a mortal self. And you need to snip it off. Right? It's a boat anchor. It cannot, be ascended.
Yeah. To me, what's assuring is that... Who wrote this paper?
Melchizedek.
He makes it sound, which is good in a way. He makes it sound takes the fear out of death. Makes it sound like, the bonds of this emancipation all makes it sound from his point of view, because he knows what's at the other side, that it's a good thing. That makes it sound like you're kind of entrapped in something that you may think it's the end of, the be-all and end-all right now, but wait till later on when it's not so bad after all.
And the challenge, is to recognize that the self, yourself that's going to ascend doesn't technically die, really, in the way we, you know, normally think of that word. It's unconscious for a span of time. That Morantia self is not conscious for a period. But it doesn't, you know, die in the final sense, right, like your mortal self does, right? You know, a Morantia self is an immortal self, right? It's not a mortal self, you know? So it doesn't, quote-unquote, die like we normally think of dying. Right, so, you know, that's the whole thing. The part of you that's ascending doesn't die, right? You just need to recognize that, you know, that you don't actually, you know, in an internal sense, you know, relative to eternity, you don't have to experience death. You know, the you that ascends doesn't die, right? You just have to trust that it's you, right? That takes trust because you are not conscious of it right now and you're not going to be. There's no way you can squint your eyes and query it just to make sure it's there. You know, you've got to trust that it's there. You know, that's why in the Adjuster Papers it says trust everything beyond the dead level of consciousness, right? There's that thin little level of consciousness in your mindal self. Most of your mindal self is an unconscious domain, either below or above that thin little level where you're conscious. You know, and it's that part of your unconscious mindal self that's above where you're conscious that's being copied into that Morantia self. That Morantia self is conscious, right? But you're not conscious of it.
Though they say everybody is aware of their soul, their own soul. When they do say that.
I mean, the only thing that you can be aware of is sort of your quote-unquote soul. Sometimes they use the word soul to not mean that actual Morantia self, but they mean the part of your mindal self that's copied into the soul. You know, it's the effective soul. It's not the literal soul.
They say that when you can't really explain it, but everybody is aware.
Yeah, and they point out, yeah, if you get to be first circular, you may actually start to get a little bit of awareness of that other self, the one that's going to ascend. Right? But right now, no. Right? You know, any more than you're going to be conscious of your adjuster. Right? So, you know, the challenge is to just recognize that it's not what humans have always thought. The self that's thinking right now doesn't get resurrected. Everyone has always thought that what gets resurrected is what's conscious right now. That's not the way it works. I mean, the fifth epical revelation is a radical, you know, break from anything that any human has ever thought about death and resurrection. Right? Jesus' mortal self was not resurrected. It died. Period. End of story. Right? Mortal selves are just that. Mortal. Right? The only thing that can get resurrected is an immortal self. Right? A mortal self can't be resurrected. That's illogical. Right? You know, it's not ongoing. That's why it's called mortal. Right? The reason that it can be resurrected is because it's fundamentally an ongoing fact, right? And it can be unconscious for a while and then reconsciousized, right? That's a different matter. Right, so, you know, so really death and resurrection is, you know, going unconscious and then becoming conscious again for that Morantia self. That's what's actually going on, right? What's dying stays dead.
That's how you remember who you are.
And I mean, you know, that's you that's being resurrected. It's just the, you know, the best of you.
You know?
And just appreciating that the best of you, you're not conscious of. So it's an, you know, you turn it around. You know, when you're really hard on yourself, thinking, oh, I'm a worthless blob of protoplasm, you know, why doesn't God just, you know, put an end to me? I mean, what use am I to the world? Remember, you know, the best part of you, you're not conscious of. Stop judging yourself by the tiny little measure that you're conscious of your mindal self. Right? It's a tiny little part of your mindal self that's conscious right now. Right? So trust. Trust that you're a child of God. Right? Most of what is an actual child of God, you're not conscious of. See? That's why a lot of times it doesn't seem like you're a child of God. It seems like you're a worthless blob of protoplasm. Right? Because that's mostly what you're conscious of, is the mind that's, you know, resting right on the blob of protoplasm. right? You know, the real child of God is mostly a superconscious phenomenon.
You know, what do you get out of this life?
You get it right. Yeah, you get a beginning out of this life, right? You know, and we've talked about that. Remember, a lot of it's like, well, why have so all this conscious self that doesn't really go anywhere? Well, that's a very selfish viewpoint of the universe, right? You know, you think it's all about you. It's like, well, if my conscious self isn't about me, why does it even exist? Well, there's other things in the universe besides you, like the Supreme. The only way the Supreme can evolve is for there to be all of these mortal selves conscious and functioning right now, right? I mean, because all of that, all those mortal selves get reflected into the Almighty, you know, the upwelling part of the Supreme, right? That's what those, most of our conscious selves are just a means to produce the Almighty, right? They're not, it's not all about us, right?
Well, and in this life, there is the culture and civilization that's an ongoing fact that doesn't die with us.
Right, there's also that,
we
too,
participate
of course.
In it, and it's our mortal self that's involved in it. That's a
way to make the Almighty thing I was just talking about less abstract. I mean, you can see the Almighty, upwelling Almighty made stuff by looking at an evolutionary world, you know, as a whole, and its evolution, right? The evolution of this planet is the evolution of the Almighty, right? It's his body, basically. All of the physical aspects of the universe of universes is the evolving Almighty Supreme, effectively, right? So, you know, that's a way, you know, that you don't have to, you know, just trust in something that's very abstract. Everyone can know enough history to know that there's, an evolutionary phenomenon here and that it's getting better and better. Now this world, that's because the Supreme is evolving ever forward. Right? So you can see the Supreme. It's like putting marker dots on the invisible Supreme, you know, to watch evolution, you know, material evolution. Yeah, and you got something too?
And we get to be Eggendonters, and that there's something to be said with having history here and experience here that we can recognize and remember after we get there.
Yeah. But just, you know, we'll move on now, but, you know, just to stress it again, I've done this a few times, you know, just remember, and your first duty is to the cosmos. Right? That's your moral duty, your duty to the cosmos, your duty to the whole. Okay? So, just appreciate that's never been, you know, understood before either. It takes some getting used to that. Most of what you're conscious of, you know, is about that duty you have to the whole. There'll be plenty of time for you, the individual, right? You've got eternity to focus on that situation and make some progress along those lines. So just do that thing that you know is one of the very first things that you're supposed to be working on exercising, patience. Be patient about the evolution of you as an individual. It'll come around in due time, right? Be the tadpole right now. The tadpole contributes to the Supreme. Eventually you'll be a frog, right? And it'll be more about you, the individual. But while you're a tadpole, most of what you're doing is being loyal, humble, patient, etc., to the process of the evolution of the whole. Being a mostly ignorant of the details, contributor to that big process, right? Right? You know, and so when you say, well, why have this life? You know, the reason we have that question is because the whole is very inscrutable. Right? But that's mainly why, you know, you have this life.
Doesn't mean you shouldn't strive for what you believe.
Right. Right.
Is God's will in your life, or that right. kind of, to do the best you
but
can.
But it's just in terms of, you know, looking, you know that you have a definitive beginning here. That's why, you know, that's right. why you're here. But all of the sort of the substance, you know, that doesn't seem to be just, you know, it's like, okay, I began when I was born or conceived or something like that, I'd say, you know, or when I was six maybe or whatever I want to say. You know, what about all those other years? It's like, you know, that don't seem to be part of the beginning. Well, you know, it's like, where's the meaning of all those years? Mostly it's in the supreme. It's in the whole. It's not in the individual. The meaning for the individual come around. Right now, there's not a lot of meaning to the individual. There's just the value of the individual. And, you know, so and that's the initiation. If you take the thing and you give it a connection to the spiritual father so that there's value, you know, that's a spirit word, right? That's a potential for meaning eventually. But it doesn't happen very significantly to begin with, you know? The father, the initiator, the spiritual father, right, is putting in place the potential for individual meaning down the road. But initially, it's not that sort of individualized value that's producing meaning. It's the collective value that's producing meaning. Right? You know, the individual will come around. Okay. So, I mean, maybe that's important that we kind of went off what seems like a tangent there. There's another way to reflect about these things we're going to read about here is, you know, why have all this variation, right? Again, it has to do with all of the diversity that is possible in terms of those in that initial time as an individual. And it's like we talked about with all the different types we've been reading about. You know, and when they say that basically you leave all that behind and you go to the mansion world, it's like, well, what's the point of all that difference then? Right? You can see, it seems like it's pointless because you're thinking just about you, the individual. Right? It's not so much about you, the individual, that there's all this diversity. It's about the Supreme. Right? The individuals don't so much need that diversity. The Supreme does. You know? And so we, you know, we are contributing. It's like, okay, I will be a non-breather, right? You know, and because the Supreme needs that, or I'll be a low gravity type because the Supreme needs that, or you know, whatever it is. But me, the individual, I'm gonna leave that behind, you know, in fairly short order. But I can look back on it and know I did my part. Maybe small relative to the whole grand universe, but I did my part for the Supreme by being patient and being that kind of oddball creature for a while because the Supreme needed it.
Well, being a rebellion planet, being a decimal planet, being all these things.
I mean, all those things.
All the failures that we have. This makes us priceless. So far as our experience goes, a lot of it does stay, but we have that core is still there.
Yeah. So just see, you know, put yourself in a bigger context. You know, that remember, you're not just a child of God. That's the fourth epical revelation. Right? The fifth is that you're a cosmic citizen. Right? So you're still an individual, you're a citizen, right? But you're in a cosmos. There is a system too, right? And so some of the things that you're up to are about you, the individual, but a lot of stuff is going to be that about that much bigger fact, the whole system, right? And that's, you know, that it's not until the fifth epical revelation that humans have had any concept like that, of how much they're part of something bigger themselves naturally. You know, humans are always trying to, I want to be part of something bigger than myself. You know, humans are always saying that. It's like, you are by nature. You know, if you would just choose to take a hold of that, you know, relationship to the cosmos that you have by grace, instead of trying to fabricate a cosmos magically out of, you know, your existential individuality, right? Humans are constantly trying to create the web of connectivity. You know, that's already there. Just connect into it. Take delight in cultivating, being part of the whole that you are by nature, the something bigger than yourself that you are by nature. Don't go searching for it. It's already there. Just take a hold of it and begin a reflective life. And you are immediately part of something bigger than yourself.
Claim it.
Yeah, just claim it, right? You know, it's like the people that spend all their life searching for God when, you know, and a fragment of God lives within them. You know, this is just the mother side, right? It's true both for the father and the mother. Spend your whole life searching for one parent or the other. You have them both by grace. Just take a hold of it. Claim your relationship to both parents. You know? All right. What else do we have here?
From time to time, on motion of the planetary authorities or the system rulers, special resurrections of the sleeping survivors are conducted. Such resurrections occur at least every millennium of planetary time. But many of those who sleep in the dust awake. These special resurrections are the occasion for mobilizing special groups of ascenders for specific service in the local universe plan of mortal ascension. There are both practical reasons and sentimental associations connected with these special resurrections.
Okay, we've mentioned, you know, this bit about special resurrections a little bit before. They're giving a little expansion on this. Because you can see the first item here is mortals of the dispensational, you know, or group. So they want to up front just, you know, remind you of the special things of the special resurrections, and then the millennial ones, you know, that are also group resurrections. And they never miss an opportunity to play off of a Bible passage, you know, if they can. So they grab a hold of that little snippet out of Daniel where, in Daniel, it seems to be talking about end times sort of stuff. But they're saying, no, the better thing is to think about is just think about individuals being resurrected. It's not just because you'd have an end times that you might have a group thing happening, right? And that fact that you actually have that passage that from Daniel that says many, yeah, it just works perfectly. So they can take a hold of that one. And use it as say there's a truth flowing through that relative to the special resurrections. Not all, but many. All would be a dispensational resurrection. See, so very clever use of the Bible there. And let's see. And then the fact that they give you a little clue. Yeah, I think we mentioned this before. A specific service in the local universe plan. Right? There's a group of individuals that fit into some, you know, bigger picture. It's like, oh, we need this, you know, these individuals now rather than, you know, 100,000 years from now at the dispensational resurrection or whatever, because they can work with those individuals and, you know, whatever the heck's going on. There's some sort of a usefulness for them sooner. And, you know, this whole bit about sentimental associations, is just, it's not just for the sake of sentiment, but the fact that sometimes, you know, I mean, they tell you this in other places, some of these functional groups that end up, you know, working, you know, up through our ascension, some of those functional groups actually get started on nativity spheres, right? So, you know, it may be that you're involved in a group now that isn't just a scaffolding phenomenon, that it's a beginning of something, you know, where those group of mortals will be working together for maybe a long span of time as an ascender, right? And so, you know, those associations of close, you know, individuals, you know, where there would be sentiment, right? See, that's what they're getting at. Is there, did you have something else there? Okay. Okay, so any questions on...
So is this basically saying that millennia is 1,000 years, right? Every 1,000 years, you know, many, so a bunch of people get resurrected one way or another. And in, and maybe in between then, as you just mentioned, various other groups get resurrected time to time, depending. And does it think it has to do at all with the circle attainment of the people?
Indirectly.
Okay.
But, you know... I mean, obviously, there may be some prerequisites for functioning in a certain group that you need to function with on high. You know, so you need to hit the ground running as a third circler or something, you know.
Or four.
Or whatever. Yeah, I don't know.
Okay.
Right? But it's not directly because of circle. Right? It would just be indirect. Because, you know, they're telling you the basics there.
Everybody in this room... they'll die, and as far as they're concerned, they resurrect almost immediately, no matter how long it takes.
Right, no matter how long it takes. If it's 500,000 years before you're resurrected, you know, it'll just be close your eyes, open your eyes from your perspective, right? It doesn't make any difference, right?
Okay,
okay, and then let's get this other little paragraph because it gets some more on this, fleshes this out.
Throughout the earlier ages of an inhabited world, many are called to the mansion spheres at the special and millennial resurrections. But most survivors are repersonalized at the inauguration of a new dispensation associated with the advent of a divine son of planetary service.
Right, see, so yeah. See, there's one of the cases where they literally spell them both out, the special and the millennial resurrections. Yeah, like I said, sometimes they'll say special and they mean both of those together, right? But notice, you know, okay, yeah, many, yes, but most, right? So when you don't have a situation where there's a lot of people getting to third circler so that they're individual ascenders, right? That's what they're setting up here, is the dispensational resurrection thing. They just, you know. So that most are being resurrected in dispensational resurrections, just with the little asterisk that they just explained, except for special and millennial, you know. But doesn't matter how many that many is, it's not most, right?
So we in the early ages?
Yes. Yes.
Even knowing if without a rebellion we may not have been?
I mean, and how do we know that we're in early ages? When you read the Light and Life paper, they tell you when a world gets to Light and Life, now finally a lot of individuals are getting to third circler during their mortal life. Okay, they're living 500 years on a world that's so advanced compared to ours we can't even imagine it, and now large numbers are starting to get to third circler during the mortal life.
But we might be further along had we been for rebellion.
Right. Oh, yeah. We'd be much further along, but we wouldn't be, you know, we wouldn't be enlightened life, right? I mean, remember in the normal span, you know, it's at least tens of thousands of years that you're in each of those dispensations,
right.
You know. So it's a long process to get to light and life, right? Again, it's just, you know, that's one of the most jarring statements in the book when they say that you get to light and life on a world and now significant numbers are reaching third circular and you're thinking, okay, I'm probably seventh. Right? It's just, that's a pretty sobering statement. So just settle in for the long haul. All right. All right, so setting aside special and millennial, you know, we're just going to look at the difference between dispensational and individual. See, that's the next two groups here. Okay.
One, mortals of the dispensational or group order of survival. With the arrival of the first adjuster on an inhabited world, the guardian seraphim also make their appearance. They are indispensable to terrestrial escape. Throughout the life lapse period of the sleeping survivors, the spiritual values, and eternal realities of their newly evolved and immortal souls are held as a sacred trust by the personal or by the group guardian seraphim.
Just one little thing there. You're going, wait a minute, aren't guardian seraphim until you get your first adjuster, until there's the first adjuster? But remember, the first pair of mortals on a world are special. Nyan and Infanta, in our case, you know, are special. I mean, they definitively get adjusters, and so they have, you know, so there's guardian angels right away, right? It's not like it's going to be some long time before there's any guardian angels on a planet. Okay, so those first pair kickstart, you know, all this stuff. Right, the children of the first pair of mortals aren't, you know, may not necessarily, you know, be that advanced. But the first pair are precocious. I mean, it's kind of in the fact that they push themselves over the threshold from animal to human. Right, it just speaks to their precocious nature. Right, they're the spear point. So it's not surprising that they always definitively are going to get adjusters, and they're going to get the process started. They have adjusters, so then their kids will get adjusters automatically when they're roughly age six. And right, it's only when you have back mating and things decay and stuff that you end up having lines of people that aren't automatically getting adjusters because their parents didn't have adjusters, and you got to meet those other prerequisites for adjuster indwelling and all that sort of stuff, like getting to third circler or whatnot. Right? But normally it's supposed to be a world of grace, right? I mean, there's supposed to be an awful lot of grace involved. All right, so you get things going, you know, like in our case, it was 500,000 years before the prince and his staff arrived, right? So there were humans for 500,000 years before there was the first resurrection, first dispensational resurrection. And it was almost that long until there was the next dispensational resurrection, right, with Adam and Eve. Right, so you got this whole long stretch of mortals that are being stored up, right, for a big dispensational resurrection. Okay.
The group guardians of assignment to the sleeping survivors always function with the judgment sons on their world advents. Quote, he shall send his angels, and they shall gather together his elect from the four winds, unquote. With each seraphim of assignment to the repersonalization of a sleeping mortal, there functions the returned adjuster, the same immortal father fragment that lived in him during the days in the flesh, and thus is identity restored and personality resurrected. During the sleep of their subjects, these awaiting adjusters serve on Divinington. They never indwell another mortal mind in this interim.
Okay, now, these are just tiny little thumbnail sketches that we get here. I mean, everyone who's familiar with the book knows that there's places that expand on all this in much greater detail. So, just little... reminder lines, that you need to take in context, like this statement, serve on Divinington. Okay, if you go up to paper 112, where they give you, all of the details, some of them aren't literally serving on Divinington. Maybe they're on Paradise or whatever. I mean, but they are serving, with Divinington as their anchor point, obviously. Right? So don't overplay this as an absolute fact sort of a statement. It's kind of just more of a true statement, where the factual details are given in other places. And it's important to note that because you have a number of statements like that here that you don't want to overplay, right? Or it's going to seem like they're in conflict with another part of the book. Right? This is just a little thumbnail sketch, just a little reminder. Basically for you to, oh yeah, that's right, I remember that, and I can go to, I think that's section 4 in paper 112, and I can look up all the different, specific things. Here you got a quote again from the Bible, and you saw that one they did before was from Daniel. So you're thinking, oh, they're probably pulling quotes from one of three places where they're, you know, where there's end times sort of stuff in the Bible, and you'd be correct in that that guess. It's not Revelation. It's, you know, there's three spots. There's Daniel, Revelation, and the 24th chapter of Matthew. Okay, this is from the 24th chapter of Matthew. And you say, well, what about the parallels in, you know, in Mark or Luke? Well, in many ways, it's in Matthew that you have something that's more kind of in line with all of the apocalyptic aspects of, you know, of Revelation and Daniel. And like, for instance, if you look at this line in Mark, it's not quite this line. You can tell this has actually been taken from Matthew. The second clause there, they shall, you know, shows you that it's from Matthew and not Mark. But if you look, they did an interesting thing. They took the apocalyptic chunk out of that sentence in Mark, or in Matthew, excuse me, in Matthew. He shall send his angels, and they skip the next little chunk about a trumpet being blown. Right? So they dropped the little trumpet part.
We blows that trumpet.
Right, because they said, you know, we know that we're not talking about angels of the trumpet sort of thing happening here. This isn't some sort of a, you know, apocalyptic moment here. This is just, you know, the normal sort of resurrection process we're talking about here. Right, so it's just, you know, it's fun to see how they use the Bible like that. You know, what things they drop out, how they modify. But it's basically verbatim, except for dropping the little trumpet chunk out of it. Okay, out of Matthew 24. Let's see here. Right, so we basically, you know, everyone I think basically knows, you know, the bit about, you know, the seraphim are there with the Marantia brain, quote unquote, with the soul. A body's built, you know, they put the Marantia brain into the Marantia body. The adjuster plugs back in, and boom, you're animate again, and the consciousness is off and rolling again. You know, that the consciousness of your Marantia self right now picks up right where it left off, because it just quote unquote goes to sleep for a little bit and then wakes up, right? So it just picks up right where it left off. You know, it's not your mortal self that's picking up where it left off. Right. It's your Marantia self that picks up where it left off in a very literal way. Go to sleep, wake up. Right? Pick up right where you left off.
But you do leave all the debris.
Right. The debris, quote unquote, the mortal debris self,
yeah,
right, doesn't wake up again. It's mortal. It's not resurrected. You know, it can't pick up where it left off, right? You know, it reaches a dead end, literally. Right?
Spiritual values and eternal realities.
Yeah, so it's a very kind of a sweeping thing, but I mean, you have the meanings and values of you know, your potentially immortal self. You know, you're thinking about the upper domain of the hourglass analogy of your mindal self, right? It's that upper domain that is basically an unconscious domain. That is being copied. You know, the meanings and values of the motions of that mind are copied into a Marantia self. And the reason they use the word reality is because it isn't just copied into Marantia mind energy, right? It's also copied into literal Marantia substance. It's realityized as a thing, right? An object. You know, just reminding you that Marantia substance is kind of like mind-made substance. So you take the mind of your, you know, in the upper domain of the hourglass analogy, and it gets expressed in a twofold fashion, a part that's kind of solidified as Marantia substance, and then the more fluid-like Marantia mind that plays upon that, rests upon that. But it's all together a copy of that spiritualized adjutant mindal self that you have right now. And think about, well, why does it need to have that sort of substance-like part, realityized part, that Marantxa, actual Marantxa substance part? Because there's a, even though it's not immediately apparent, that mind that that's in the upper domain in the hourglass analogy of you right now has a framework in which it exists, a foundation upon which it rests. It is, it has a, one of its qualities is a stability, and that stability is realityized. You know, it's literally that that stability quality of that mind that literally becomes a substance that's stable. You know. Right? So it's not so abstract. That stability, you know, is literally is made object. Right. So you can think of the actual Marantxa substance of your, you know, of your soul, as being a you know, a realization of the stability of your personal self.
Is it the thought adjuster that stabilizes that, or just?
Well, the thought adjuster, you know, is the nucleating agent, right, for that stability. But it isn't the totality of that stability, right? Because, it, again, see, that's what I'm saying. I mean, because you still have that nucleating agent, you know, is going to plug back into that soul, right? You know, so it's like, well, what, you know, that's what I'm saying. What exactly is that literal stuff, that Marantxa stuff? What exactly, precisely, is it a copy of? It's not a copy of sort of the fluidity of your higher mind. That's the Marantxa mindal self that's seated on that stuff. Right? It's a copy of the foundational framework integrity of that mind.
Integrity.
Okay?
Does it tie into the 100 elements in the pre-periodic table?
In some way that we totally understand, that you know, that literal soul, that Marantxa object, is made out of Marantxa atoms. Yes, right? You know, and you could, you know, you'll be able to know the physics of that. You know, when you wake up, it's like, you know, is there Marantxa oxygen in it? Marantxa carbon? You know, Marantxa gold? You know, what's my, you know, what atoms, Marantxa atoms, are in my soul? Does it take all 100 atoms to make a soul? 10 of them? Who knows? You know, and those atoms are in some sort of Marantxa molecules. What kind of Marantxa molecules, you know, does it take, you know, are there Marantxa analogs of you know, carbon, you know, hydrocarbon chain molecules? Or, I mean, who knows? I have no idea, right? But yeah, there's a whole physics to that Marantxa object too, right?
What gets me is how the thought adjuster actually does that.
Yeah, and not even none of the revelators know, in general, because that's a secret of Ascendington. Right? One of the secrets of Ascendington.
Ascendington,
right? One of the secrets of Ascendington is how an adjuster can produce Marantxa substance when there's no Marantxa power supervisors. Mm-hmm. See, that's a mystery, because normally to make Marantxa substance, you need Marantxa power supervisors. Somehow you're getting Marantxa substance without them. That's a secret of Ascendington.
So we'll learn that sometime.
We'll know that secret, yes. Yeah. you know, whereas the solitary messenger will never know that.
Wow.
Yeah, but we will. Okay, go ahead.
While the older worlds of mortal existence harbor those highly developed and exquisitely spiritual types of human beings who are virtually exempt from the Marantxa life, the earlier ages of the animal origin races are characterized by primitive mortals who are so immature that fusion with their adjusters is impossible. The reawakening of these mortals is accomplished by the guardian seraphim in conjunction with an individualized portion of the immortal spirit of the third source and center.
Right. And of course, speaking in that very generalized way, more specifically, right? It's a fragment, a spirit fragment of the Creative Mother Spirit. Right, that's the individualized, you know, portion there that they're talking about. And, you know, again, see, just a quick little reminder that you've got spirit-fused mortals, not just father-fused. You know, and again, just remember why. I mean, primitive mortals who are so immature that fusion with their adjusters is impossible.
Well,
ever, period. Why? Because remember what in order to fuse with an adjuster, there has to be something that's adjuster-like, right? You have two parents. The father's side is just there by fiat in completed fashion. That adjuster fragment is there. Okay? In relationship to your other parent, another element is grown until it's adjuster-like and confused with an adjuster. Right? The mother portion of the fusion pair, right, doesn't come together all at once like the fiat father, right? It evolves into existence. Right? That's the whole psychic circles thing, is, you know, greater and greater relationship with your other parent until finally your mind that is coming from the mother is like the part that came from the father, and that so the two are alike and confused. Right? But there's no magic here. I mean, there are some minds that can't be evolved into something that's adjuster-like. Right? That's no matter how much you evolve them, there's a disconnect, right? You know, if I put my two hands above each other like this, yeah, I move them horizontally, the two hands don't meet, right? That's what you've got. There's no way to get the mother side up to eye level with the adjuster so that there can be fusion. Right? You have to have so the other side has to be a downstepped fragment, right? Fragments of the reflective mother spirits or fragments of the creative mother spirits, you know, are downstepped more so that, you know, the other side can actually evolve up at eye level with them and fuse with them, right? Like to like. Okay.
Well, I'm hearing an apparent conflict.
Mm-hmm.
Say apparent, yep. Because I know there can't really be a conflict, but I've got the idea on the mansion worlds. Over time,
mm-hmm.
all differences will be compensated for. Whether I'm short, fat, dull, or brilliant in this
some
life,
cases.
Mm-hmm.
In the Marantia world, that can be compensated for.
Right.
But what I'm hearing you say here is that based upon one's beginning, that something essential is not there in the resurrected life that can be brought up to the level of adjuster fusion.
Right. Right.
So there's a...
Right. Again, so if I have a spirit fuser, and if I use the hourglass analogy of their mindal self, right, I mean, they have an upper domain, they have a temple within, right, but that mind that's in that, you know, that upper domain is, you know, is upstepped, spiritualized adjutant mind from the lower domain, right, it, and you know, it is predicated on the quality of that mind that's in the lower domain. And you know, it's you know, there's no discontinuity between the upper domain and the lower domain, right? It's you know, it's continuously, you know, transitions up from the brain to the lower domain of the hourglass, to the upper domain of the hourglass, and that upper domain is what's copied into the Marantia self. So, I mean, all you're recognizing is through your, you know, what you're bringing in is that that Marantia self is fundamentally limited. That's a Marantia self that can't be brought up to adjuster likeness.
That's predicated on the mortal mind.
Right, and it's all predicated, you know, on the genetics of, you know, ultimately you go all the way down and everything is attuned to the genetics of that ascender. Right, and that's why, you know, a spirit member, a spirit fuser fuses, you know, when they're resurrected, they fuse with that spirit fragment. Right? You are creative mother spirit fragment like by grace. I mean, right now, the encirclement that she gave you in the Holy Spirit, that initial thread that she gave you, is like her. I mean, it could fuse with a spirit fragment of her right now. Right? You know, only you aren't limited by that kind of starting point. You can go beyond that. But some mortals that are very primitive can't. Right? They have a lower ceiling. You know, it's just an example of, I mean, a fish can only go up to a certain level of agitant mind, and it has a ceiling. It can't go any higher than that. It doesn't matter how many millions of years, hundreds of millions of years, fish evolve.
That's it.
Right? Yeah. You just have all these different ceilings that people, you know, that animals or, you know, mortals reach. Some here first. Yep.
Winston says the individual resurrection, I think I might understand. So is the millennial 1,000 years? And
yes.
The dispensation resurrection could be 100 to 50,000 years? Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, just go to the Planetary Mortal Epics paper, you know, that we'll get to here in a little bit, and you can see some of the time spans. Yeah. Hundreds or tens of thousands of years, these dispensations last a very long time. Yeah. Okay, so some over here.
So we're just talking about, remember when Jesus gained it, you know, and mm-hmm. Jesus stopped to give a coin to the beggar, he refuses, like, happened to turn to it, refused to speak comforting. And, you know, and Canaan said, well, why didn't you? And he says, why waste words upon one who can't perceive the meaning of what you say? The Spirit of the Father cannot teach and save one who has no capacity for sonship.
Mm-hmm.
Now, does that mean, when that's in that case, that that's not even a spirit-fused person or a son-fused person, so to speak? Or is that hard to really say?
Right, I mean, if...
He's still a human being.
Right, if they have no capacity for sonship, I mean, you know, they may not be a human being at all. They may be subhuman.
In that case.
Yeah.
Obviously, looked like a human.
Right, I mean, they have this shaped body and everything. But, you know, if it's so limited genetically that the seventh adjutant can't even engage it, right, it can't reach human nature.
And he could recognize that.
Yeah. And, you know, and that's who he's talking about when he says, you know, if I came upon a phenomenon like that, a subhuman phenomenon that was aggressive, you know, I would spare no, force to defend myself, because it's, right, I mean, it's not really human, you know, it's just only a fancy animal, literally, not just functioning as a fancy animal, but still genuinely human. It's just subhuman, period. Yeah, you know, and when they say capacity, you know, they're purposely using that word because you want to immediately think that is the volume in the hourglass analogy, right? That upper domain is the quote unquote capacity they're always talking about. She gives you capacity. Because she has that type of deity, capacity type deity, so that she can give you that capacity, you know, that you're literally visualizing as a volume in the hourglass analogy, right? And if you don't have that upper domain of the hourglass, someone who's subhuman only has a lower domain of the hourglass. They don't have a temple within. They don't have an upper domain. Okay.
Thus are the sleeping survivors of a planetary age repersonalized in the dispensational roll calls. But with regard to the non-salvable personalities of a realm, no immortal spirit is present to function with the group guardians of destiny. And this constitutes cessation of creature existence. While some of your records have pictured these events as taking place on the planets of mortal death, they all really occur on the mansion worlds.
Okay, so that's, you know, notice how they felt they needed to throw in that last little line, because, you know, you can read all kinds of things where humans have talked seemingly along these lines, and it seems like some sort of resurrection is happening on a, you know, on our world. No, that's not the case, any more than angels have wings, right? same sort of thing. Now, this again, you know, these are just little snippets, you know, and this is a reminder of something we often talk about. And again, it's expanded upon up in paper 113. I mean, if you're interested where that is, it's in section 6 of paper 113. Old single column, page 1247. That's where they have that, or they say, you know that line from the Bible? There is a validity to that, the quote-unquote resurrection of the unjust, quote-unquote. So it's in paper 113 about the guardians of destiny that they bring that up. And remember, I often refer to that, which is what they're talking about here. You've got this soul. I mean, it's known that it's empty, right? That the person is completely bankrupted. They've depleted all meaning and value out of that soul. It's just an empty vessel now. But nonetheless, the seraphim is still has it in her trust. Takes it to the first mansion world. They build a body for it. They put that Merantia brain, you know, that soul into that Merantia body. They step back. They go through all the, you know, throw the switches, whatever the heck they have to do. But the adjuster doesn't come back. Right? Doesn't plug in, so nothing reanimates. They go through the whole process so everyone can see that there's nothing there. Right? No one was just lazy that day and didn't look closely to see that there actually still was one little pebble rattling around in that soul. It is completely empty. Right? Nothing to resurrect. Right, so that's what they mean by non-salvable. Right? It's another issue, right? If you've got mortals that never got an adjuster and hence a soul in the first place, okay, that's not quote unquote non-salvable. That's just a drop of water in the ocean of the Supreme that never genuinely separated itself, right? And it just goes back, to what it genuinely is, just a drop of water in the ocean of the Supreme, right? And that's where the way all of us start, relative to that other parent, right? There's just an ocean, and you're trying to coalesce a drop out of that until it's finally genuinely separate from the Supreme, right? And you aren't technically non-meltable back into the Supreme until you fuse with your adjuster. Right? Anytime prior to that, you're still technically a drop of water that could become part of the ocean again. Right? You're still mortal until you fuse. Right? I mean, so that's another way to think about what that adjuster fragment is giving you, is the potential to pull yourself out of the ocean of the Supreme, glue yourself to something that is outside of the ocean. Right? Because it came from the Father. It came from outside of the inside where the mother is, right? So, I mean, anything that starts on the inside with the mother, right, is confined to the inside. There's no way to actually get fundamentally separate from that. You're given that fact from the outside so that you essentially are pulled out of the ocean, pulled out of the inside effectively. Right? You're literally connected to eternity outside of time.
Mm-hmm. And that's for the individuals who if they have no soul, if the individual that Gannett was referring to with that Jesus passed by was this.
Right, I mean, if that was a genuinely non-human, right? I mean, they have no adjuster, they have no soul. Adjuster. There's nothing to take up, right? And the only thing that's taken up to the first mansion world is the soul. And again, like we said, all mortal cells just die, and that's all there is to it.
But the soul arrives at Pentecost, isn't it? That's when the soul. That's when the thought adjuster is.
Well, we got the universal bestowal of thought adjusters at Pentecost,
correct.
Right? But when did you get your adjuster? I mean, you didn't get your adjuster 2,000 years ago. You weren't alive 2,000 years ago.
Right.
Each of us, gets our adjuster at roughly age 6. Right. And before you were roughly age 6, you did not have a soul. Right? Yeah. Now, and it's like, well, how could I go on? Remember, that's a little bit about the probationary nursery.
Sure.
The reason that you can go on is because you are still mindily connected to your biologic parents. Right? And like we said, it's the mindal self that's really ascending. Mm-hmm. Right? The parents' mindal selves are ascending. Right? And those children are glued to those mindal selves. Right? They're really kind of just a, you know, an extension. They haven't actually separated and become a separate mindal self yet until roughly age 16. Right? Right. So again, it just reminds you of how that probationary nursery works, the physics of it. Right? Mindal selves are ascending. You know, and if you're pre-16, so you're kind of just an appendage, you know, an extension out of, you know, your parents' mindal selves, right? Until you've bubbled off and become a separate mindal self, mindal conception, at roughly age 16, right? You're not an independent ascender, because just literally you're not an independent, you know, ascending phenomenon. You're just part of their mindal self. So how much that's like what we were just talking about with the Supreme, right? I mean, it's the same thing with relative to the Supreme. You start as just this quasi-separate thing, you know, and you're slowly extending and extending, you know, differentiating yourself from the Supreme until finally you separate and actually become separate from the Supreme. Mm-hmm. All right. Okay, what about individual ascenders here?
Two, mortals of the individual orders of ascension. The individual progress of human beings is measured by their successive attainment and traversal or mastery of the seven cosmic circles. These circles of mortal progression are levels of associated intellectual, social, spiritual, and cosmic insight values. Starting out in the seventh circle, mortals strive for the first, and all who have attained the third immediately have personal guardians of destiny assigned to them. These mortals may be repersonalized in the Maruncha life, independent of dispensational or other adjudications.
Okay, so you've broken yourself free from having to be part of a group resurrection. And just notice the way they wonderfully summarize the whole issue of the psychic circles, focusing very definitively on speaking of them as cosmic circles or cosmic levels. Progression are levels of associated, right? You know, so whether you think of it in circle fashion, going inward in concentric circles, or going upward on levels, they're not spiritual circles or spiritual levels. They're cosmic circles, they're cosmic levels. Just the fact that you call them psychic. Psyche is Greek for soul, right? A soul is not a spiritual object, it's a cosmic object, right? It has a warp and a woof. It's a weave. You know, it has the full cosmic triunity aspect to it. And throwing in the parenthetical, right? I mean, what another way of thinking about that progress up those cosmic levels. They're not just quote unquote cosmic levels, they're levels of self-mastery. See how they threw in the parenthetical of mastery there. Right? That's what it's about, consecrating your mind to the universal harmony of God the Mother. It's about that other parent, right? And when you think about just the Mother, that parent, right? You know, you can just think about you're moving up cosmic levels. Your mind is becoming closer and closer to the ceiling of those levels, her universal harmony. You know, you're approaching her harmony. It's like, well, how can I bring in the other parent? Well, that's why you use the circle analogy. Because at the same time that she's growing you up those levels, you supply the favorable conditions, she grows you up those levels. You can think of that, an analogy, as being grown inward in circles. And so this mother fact is moving inward towards a father fact at the center of those circles. Right? And the two parents, the part of you from each of the two parents is coming together. And that's why they use the circle analogy. So you can think about how the mother, you can picture the mother parent, you know, what you're getting from the mother parent being related to what you get from the father parent. And how the two come together. But, you know, if you don't want to bring in the father, you know, you can just think about levels, moving up levels in relationship to the cosmos. Okay. But again, see, it's like you can't build a relationship to an adjuster. You have to be grown into relationship with your adjuster. Okay. That's why Jesus didn't teach character building. He taught character growth. Okay. Because you just apply the favorable conditions and trust. You will be grown, you know, upward and inward, whichever way you want to think about it. You know, and the very fact that they're cosmic levels, you know, spiritual is just one of the elements, see, in that list. Okay? They're not spiritual levels. You can't move up them by spiritual choice, by just what you have because of how the Father touched you. You can't build up those levels. And, you know, by building, you mean you can. It means you can just exercise spiritual choice and build up the level. No, they're not spiritual level. They're cosmic levels. So no amount of exercising your will in and of itself moves you up those levels because they're not spiritual levels. You can move up spiritual levels, but that's separate from, you know, getting closer to your adjuster. You can't build yourself closer to your adjuster. You have to be grown by the mother inward towards the adjuster.
Yeah, I'm looking at that list. Associated intellectual, social, spiritual, and cosmic insight values.
Yeah.
Those are all descriptors for the word values.
Yep.
Which is the spirit word. So, and that's, there's...
But it's reminding you it's a spirit word in the triunity. It's a phase. I mean, there's also meanings, you know, they aren't literally saying, but they're just reminding you, you get all those different values, and then there's the super additive consequence of thing related to value giving meaning in lots of different phases of meaning. You know, intellectual meaning that came from intellectual value, social meaning that came from social value, spiritual meaning that came from spiritual value. They're just kind of giving you different...
My question is, yeah. Are there different values at each level?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Right. I mean, see, again,
so it's not like value transcends
right.
the levels.
I mean, you're striving towards supreme value. Right? So, I mean, there's, you know, just thinking like that, you're just thinking spiritual levels, value levels, you know, with supreme values at the top. But the very fact that you call it supreme values at the top, supreme is about triunity. It's reminding you that, right, you're abstracting the spiritual, right? It's not like somehow the spirit levels exist independent. No, they're in the context of the triunity. Okay. But you're just abstracting them for a certain phase of understanding. There really aren't, quote-unquote, spiritual levels, right?
Right.
There really are only cosmic levels, you know? And spirit is a phase of that, yeah. Right. The wholeness of all levels is cosmic, is triune. I mean, that's the fifth epical revelation. Right? Humans have never been told that before, that fundamentally the reality that you're trying to come into a relationship is a triunity. Because they've never tried to reveal the mother before. They just revealed the father. And the father's just the spiritual father. Right, you have a spiritual father and a cosmic mother. You don't have a cosmic father. You have a spiritual father only. See, and so he's just the spark. You know, that spirit sparks you into relationship with the triunity. Like I was saying earlier on, I mean, you're a thing. You know, he initiates you with some value, and so there's a super additive consequence. You know? The value, the spiritual part, is the spark that sparks the triunity into existence, the initial triunity. And then it's just a matter of repeating repeatedly, you know, through endless cycles of eternity. Okay.
I don't get it. He sparked a triunity.
Right, just the fact that you can't get a superadditive consequence until you have the other end. I mean, right now I have no spirit, you know, substance in my body. I'm just material. I'm just individuality. I'm not built out of unity. But unity is brought down and touches me. And now the two can be in relationship. And I mean, I reach up and touch value as a thing. And there's a superadditive consequence of the relationship of that thing that's chosen to touch value. There's meaning. Meaning is a superadditive consequence of a relationship between thing and value.
It's the action.
I mean, value is the potential. The actualization is the meaning. And you don't just get the third element. Once there's a third, there's the encompassment of all three by your personality. Your personality encompasses the triunity. No, it's just that's the basic process, you know. And if you bias yourself to the unity side, you're short-circuiting the potential for a super-additive consequence. You know, there's a lot of spiritual people, so-called religious seekers, that try to de-individualize their mind. They try to separate themselves from the individuality of their self, right? Because they think that's what you're supposed to do. It's like, no, you are short-circuiting. The point is to take a hold of the value as definitively as you can't help but be a hold of the thing. You're made just, you know, frustratingly thing-like, right? Right? I mean, that's why people try to escape their thingness and try to just bliss into the unity. It's like, no, don't try to let go of your thingness. Find enough unity that's of equal measure to the amount of thingness that you find yourself with, and bring the two together. You know, bring that value and thing into relationship. You know, that's why people can't seem to find meaning in their life, is because they either try to live just as a thing or try to de-thingize themselves, right? De-individuate themselves and just try to somehow melt into the unity. And then they wonder why they're vainly hoping for a future of meaning. It's because there's no super-additive potential there. You know, you can't do it with just individuality or just unity. You have to delight in them equally. You know, and an awful lot of spiritually inclined people do not delight in their individuality. They come to hate it, right? They produce this very willful rejection within them. There's none so blind as those who will not see. Right? I mean, you can't do that. Expect to, you know, be anything except a seventh circler by grace. Right? You're not going to make any progress if you're doing that. You have to embrace your individuality. It's not evil.
Right? Chris, yep. This value that you talked about, we're given by grace, is mm-hmm. from the encirclement with the mother, or are you specifically referring to the...
Yeah, I mean, there's, you're not just given a mind by the mother.
Right.
She's not just a mind energy blob, right? She literally is spirit substance,
right,
as a presence. You are immersed in that spirit energy by grace. I mean, don't forget that the Holy Spirit is a spirit ministry. You know, it literally has a spirit energy ubiquity substrate to it that you are put into, right? When she encircles you in the Holy Spirit, you're literally put into a bath of spirit energy. You know, it's not your body, you know, your body is bathing in it. So indirectly, there can now be a super-additive consequence, right? if you choose to stay connected to the environment that you're immersed in, then there will be a super additive consequence. But if the only environment that you want to take a hold of is the material environment, then you can't have that. You have to choose to reach out both ends of your mind, right? Reach out the material end, take a hold of the material environment, and reach out the other end and take a hold of the spirit environment, even though you can't see it. You have a personality. It has a fingers that can grasp spirit. Right? And once you have a hold of both, there's a super additive consequence.
I think I was trying to make the difference between, or clarifying the difference between being bathed in the Holy Spirit as opposed to the introduction of the thought adjuster as being our spiritual anchor.
I mean, that, the spirit of truth and the thought adjuster just add to this, right? But see, they're not essential to getting the process going. I mean, if I didn't get a thought adjuster by grace, and it wasn't post-Pentecost, so there wasn't any spirit of truth, I mean, there's only one spirit ministry that I can potentially take a hold of, the Holy Spirit. Right? That's my means to greater and greater meaning until I get third circle meaning, and then I get an adjuster, right?
But that whole time before the adjuster, pre-Pentecost stuff, you can still build a soul.
Well, I mean, if I didn't have an adjuster by grace, I build meaning until I had third circle or meaning, and then I'd get an adjuster, and the adjuster would build a soul.
So pre-Pentecost, before adjuster.
If you weren't getting an adjuster because your parents had one, Right. You could do you could be a fourth circler, perhaps.
Say bye-bye.
And have no future, right? Because you don't have a soul.
Yeah.
It's like, well, what's the point of me going from seventh circler to fourth circler? All that, you're contributing to the Supreme, right? When all is said and done, you go, oh, that wasn't an eternal individual that was going, that was a lump in the Supreme that was evolving, right? The Supreme has to go through all of that process too. Right?
All kinds of finite things have meaning because of the Supreme.
Right. Every finite thing has meaning in the whole. The arrangement of molecules in this room has meaning to the Supreme. It doesn't have meaning to me as an individual. But everything has a meaning to the Supreme. Yes, all animals, plants, everything, right? I mean, every molecule, everything, has a meaning to the Supreme. There's no coincidence as to where the molecules are in this room right now. When all is said and done in the Supreme. So Supreme is a very profound thing, for meaning. It finds meaning where you can't even imagine there could be meaning. Okay. It's important that we took a little tangent there to stress this, because it just keeps coming back around. You've got to understand this whole bit about the difference between building, thinking you can build something, and knowing that you can't, that you can only be grown. Man cannot cause growth. All you can do is supply favorable conditions. Let go of the delusion of building something. You can't build yourself closer to the adjuster one iota. As a matter of fact, what do they tell you in the adjuster papers? If you try to do that, it's very likely that you're going to go into danger land, right? If you try to build your relationship to the adjuster, that self-righteous mentality that's fundamental to thinking you can build, you're gonna get the exact opposite of what you were looking for, right? You do not know the physics of a relationship to a deity fragment. Trust the mother to grow you so that your physics is proper, so that your relationship to the adjuster is stable. She'll grow you so that you have a stable relationship. If you try to just will it, right, you might succeed, Like they said, but you know, under no circumstances do such and so as a, you know, as a religious act. I mean, because that's very dangerous. If you get too closer to the adjuster when you can't handle being closer to the adjuster, it's just going to scramble you.
Right? What do you call the fact that you've been here every Friday night for the last 25 years? Is that not, that's providing favorable conditions, but it's also a commitment. And it, You're doing it. You're trying to get
yeah.
grown here.
Yeah, why am I, I've been sitting here for 25 years. I'm taking delight in cultivating.
Okay. But right? from other people's perspective, when it sounds confusing to say that you can't grow yourself. To them, it looks like you're growing yourself by the commitment to be here every
Friday. Right. What, that commitment to be here every Friday. And that's one of those simple elements of favorable condition that you can exercise. One of those is sincerity.
Yeah.
Am I not demonstrating sincerity? Right? And patience. And I hope humility. And I hope loyalty. Right?
And those are favorable conditions.
Those are favorable conditions. Those are very simple, straightforward, favorable conditions that you can just sort of take a hold of. You know, I can exercise humility right now in this situation. I don't need to know any physics of adjusters or anything, right?
Exercise is the operant word.
Exercise. One must do something as well as be something.
And that sounds contradictory to what it's like. You're being grown, but you are actually being proactively grown.
Yeah, I mean, recognize that that favorable, that supplying favorable conditions.
It's a verb.
See? Right? It's something that you're doing. Right? You're active. It's just you have no delusions that you somehow know how to build a first circular mind or something, the physics of all these energy systems or something. I mean, that's just ridiculous. I know nothing about those sort of things. But I know how to be humble, and I know how to be loyal, and I know how to be just. Right? I know how to be honest and law-abiding. Right? You know, so just, I mean, as long as we went off on that just, you know, let me give you those five. Right? Loyalty. Humility. Sincerity. And just, you know, which you understand as honest and law-abiding. And a fifth one that's very straightforward to understand and to exercise is patience. Yeah. So just, I mean, that'll keep you busy for the rest of your life. Just focus on those five things.
You sure say that again.
See if you can do that. Right? You know, you can worry about fancier things, you know, on the mansion world. So, you know, start with those. You know, even just being just, right? Where you don't, you aren't champing at the bit of law, right? You know, can you just, you know, do it, you know, the religious life of Jesus and how he lived it, you know? He submitted himself to the law of his day, no matter how arbitrary and foolish it might be. You know, the moment you start thinking, I'm going to, you know, revolt against my culture, no, be law-abiding. You know, and don't get so, it's like, well, yeah, but in Havona they would never have a law like that. They don't have laws in Havona, and you're a long ways from that, you know, okay? Be law-abiding and be honest, be just. Right? It's like, well, why do I want to be just? Because then maybe you could be fair. And then maybe you could be patient. And then maybe you could be kind. And then maybe you could be merciful. And then maybe you could be loving. Oh, I want to love. Yeah, well, you can't do it until you're all those other things first. Think how many people think that they're this wonderful manifestation of love, but they're not just. You know they're not honest and law-abiding. So they're delusionally loving. What they're doing is not love. They might call what they're doing love, but it's not. Because you can't love until you go through those steps first. And if you haven't even done the first step of being just, you are not genuinely loving. You're doing some first level of meaning thing and falsely calling it loving. You're not genuinely loving. Okay. No. All right. Oh, you got something? Yeah.
Everything in our culture, this is the reason why in emergency revelation it becomes more and more clear in emergency time, because everything in the culture contrasts exactly where we're supposed, what we're supposed to be striving towards. Yeah. It appears to me that we're tested, we're pushed until such time as we can figure it out.
Yeah, and again, just, you know, that initial spiritual consciousness thinks it can build everything. It thinks that it can build a self that is loving. No, a loving self has to be grown within you. It's an evolutionary universe that you live in, right? You have to supply the favorable conditions, and you will eventually be grown into a genuinely loving being. But it's a relationship to the mother that produces that. You know, it's first just, you know, next fair, and patient, etc. Right? That's the only way. It doesn't matter how much you don't want to supply all that long sequence of favorable conditions. It's the only way to become loving.
It is.
And no human has been told this until the fifth epical revelation. You know, and it's like, and it wasn't an issue until we got as much spiritual potential as we have now. Now,
it's dangerous.
Now we have delusions of grandeur that are dangerous to ourselves and to civilization, right? Where we think we can build civilization, for instance. No, you need to supply the favorable conditions, you know, and it will be grown. Civilization is a choice, yes, but the choice is to supply the favorable conditions, right? And in terms of you as an agent in civilization, the favorable condition is you being a mastered self, like they were just talking about here with the mastery. Okay.
Throughout the earlier ages of an evolutionary world, few mortals go to the judgment on the third day. But as the ages pass, more and more the personal guardians of destiny are assigned to the advancing mortals, and thus increasing numbers of these evolving creatures are repersonalized on the first mansion world on the third day after natural death. On such occasions, the return of the adjuster signalizes the awakening of the human soul. And this is the repersonalization of the dead, just as literally as when the en masse roll is called at the end of a dispensation on the evolutionary worlds.
Okay, so just two quick things there. The last bit, you know, they say that so that you don't think that there's some sort of special magic in play in a dispensational resurrection, right? It's just as literally a resurrection if it's as an individual as if you're part of a group.
It's not necessarily the walking dead.
You know, and that, you know, think about how there's a bias to that. I mean, the very fact that they took those passages out of, you know, Matthew and Daniel, right? That whole fixation on this yeah. wonderful magical group, you know, resurrection thing, right? Yeah, that's why they're saying that. Because we have a, you know, even if you don't recognize it, you've got a bias towards that sort of group thing. And the other one is, remember, these are just, they aren't speaking hyper technically and exhaustively here. These are just little thumbnail sketches. So here's another example when they say third day, right? And, you know, if you go to paper 112, like I pointed out, where you have some of this stuff explained in more exhaustive detail, right, they remind you it's not technically the third day, it's the third period. Right? Two of them are days, the day you die and the day you're resurrected. But the in-between, quote-unquote, day, you know, if you have to be transported somewhere, you know, that's different from, like, the probationary nursery to the first mansion world, which is a quick trip, right? You know, if you got to travel any distance, you know, many, many light years, right, you're going to get there in a day, right? So, yeah. So it's not literally 3 days. You know, it's going to take you a lot of years to be transported from here to the first mansion world. Your soul to be transported. Okay, so just, you know, just I wanted to stress that because you can see, you know, in the bigger context, there's several things where they're just kind of giving you a little reminder here. Don't take this as the whole story. But the same, you know, same place where you go for Divinington, the whole story, paper 112, you get there and that's where they tell you it's the third period. And they're speaking in more exhaustive, precise detail. So just appreciate that about the book, you know. You've got to challenge yourself to not be so simplistically factual about the book. And sometimes they don't want to, you know, give you all the, you know, the details. They just want to give you a little reminder. Right? And they use our concept of the quote-unquote third day as that reminder thing. And you can just, if you want to get scientific about it, you say it's the third period. Okay. I mean, why was Jesus resurrected on the third day? There's the day he died, the day he's resurrected, the day in between. Did he have to be transported anywhere? No. So it could literally be the third day, right? Right. But if you got to be transported somewhere...
Right. Quite a coincidence
that
it's Easter.
Yeah, and we're even in the Easter time here, yes. Yeah, okay, so keep going there.
There are three groups of individual ascenders. The less advanced land on the initial or first mansion world. The more advanced group may take up the Morantia career on any of the intermediate mansion worlds in accordance with their previous planetary progression. The most advanced of these orders really begin the Morantia experience on the seventh mansion world.
Let me start with that seventh one. So, you know, what's the essence of that? So, in other words, they really have completed the mansion worlds basically on their nativity sphere. They just need to do those finishing touches on the seventh so that they're ready to be part of a group that goes to Gerasim. Yeah, so they need that sort of getting acclimated to the local system and ready for Gerasim part of the seventh mansion world. You know, and then of course first mansion world on the other end of the spectrum, and then in between. Now, you know, we went through the mansion worlds. You should be asking yourself a question here. It's like, wait a minute, I thought we were talking about third circlers here as individual ascenders. And I thought we noticed that the third mansion world was basically third circular sort of status. Why would there be less advanced, you know, that have to spend an extended period of time on the first or the second mansion world? Again, something they didn't bring up here. There's more than one way to be an individual ascender, you know, to have your personal... a pair of seraphim. One of them is third circular. Up in paper 113, they tell you the other two. And another one is to be a destiny reservist. That gets you your own pair of seraphim. And then there's, if you've made what's called the supreme decision, which they explain in another spot in 113, is a supreme decision to become godlike. And you're going, well, haven't I already done that? It's like, well, no. It's a supreme decision, right? It's easy to make a decision to become godlike, a finite decision to become godlike. I'm sure everyone in this room has made a finite decision to become godlike. But have you made a supreme decision? Have you transcended the grand universe wholeness in your decision to become godlike? A supreme decision. right. So, you know, if it was someone like that, I mean, maybe they were a fifth circler when they made the supreme decision. Right? Okay, so they're not going to be going to the third mansion world. They've got some work to do before the third mansion world. See, so that's why there's a spectrum there. Because right? it could be a whole range of different people relative to the circles. You have a question?
Yeah. Have you?
I wouldn't even remotely assume that I've made a supreme decision. I don't even know what that means.
Yeah, so why do they throw it out there? We don't know what that means.
Right. Why? And why in the religion papers they tell you you should be striving for supreme values and don't be satisfied until you achieve supreme values. It's like, well, I don't really know what supreme is, so why tell me that? Right. What's the point? Don't ever think that you've reached the ceiling.
There's always the carrot out there.
Right. Ever be fundamentally dissatisfied with where you are. And you're you know, so that if I'm never satisfied, you know, if I'm always trying to reach farther, I'm at least in truth in relationship to supreme values. And maybe I might actually get to the point where in some measure I'm in fact in relationship to supreme values. But I'm certainly not going to get there if I have any tendency to be immediately satisfied with something I've done already.
And you're always progressing.
Right. You have to always be open to more. You know, never think that... That's why it's so just short-circuiting for you to think that you're a certain circler. You know, what's one of those favorable conditions that I said? Humility. Your assumption should be that you're a seventh circler, that you're a tadpole, till the end of days, right? Because the moment you think, you know, it's like, no, I've left seventh circle behind. I'm pretty sure I'm at least
arrogance.
You're starting to think that you've completed something. You should just let yourself be open.
It's interesting, this discussion about providing favorable conditions in correlation with being between the hammer and anvil.
Yeah. Yeah, and it takes courage, because pain and suffering are essential to progressive evolution. Yeah, to open yourself up to an evolutionary existence is to open yourself up to tribulation. Yeah. Okay. All right. I think we can at least get this next one here done.
3, mortals of the probationary dependent orders of ascension. The arrival of an adjuster constitutes identity in the eyes of the universe, and all indwelt beings are on the roll calls of justice. But temporal life on the evolutionary worlds is uncertain, and many die in youth before choosing the paradise career. Such adjuster indwelt children and youths follow the parent of most advanced spiritual status, thus going to the system finaliter world, the probationary nursery, on the third day at a special resurrection, or at the regular millennial and dispensational roll calls.
Right, so any different way, third day special, millennial or dispensational. You know, we already talked a lot about the probationary nursery, so we have this little, you know, thumbnail sketch. But as I mentioned back there, this little block gives you a couple things that aren't in other places. That line about, you know, that you're not really thought of as having any sort of kind of significant individuality, you know, relative to the Supreme until you have an adjuster. Now, you haven't literally separated until you fuse with that adjuster, but see, they're thinking in truth, not in fact. You know, so they're constituting identity in the eyes of the universe. Truth is enough, see? Right? It doesn't have to go all the way to fact. But if there isn't an adjuster, I mean, there's no visual evidence even of the truth, right, that you could potentially separate from the Supreme. And so that's what they're getting at there. And the whole bit about how you're, like we talked about, you're literally mindily connected to your biologic parents till roughly age 16. You know, and that doesn't change just because you have an adjuster at, say, age 6. You know, you still aren't mindily separated until roughly 16. That's the whole point of the probationary nursery, up to roughly 16. Okay, and then I'll give you a little bit more here.
Children who die when too young to have thought adjusters are repersonalized on the finaliter world of the local systems, concomitant with the arrival of either parent on the mansion worlds. A child acquires physical entity at mortal birth, but in the matter of survival, all adjusterless children are reckoned as still attached to their parents.
And that's, you know, that's as close as they get to saying it directly, you know, what I've been talking about.
Direct.
Putting it all together, yeah. Right? You have material or physical conception and birth. So first you're separate, and then you're independent materially. But you also have mindal conception and birth. Now, you won't have mindal birth until you leave the local universe. You won't be birthed out of that mindal womb until you're a first-stage spirit. But mindal conception is at roughly age 16. And that's when you become a separate mindal self, rather than just a, sort of a little extension of your biologic parents' mindal selves.
Okay. Yeah. Quick question. If you've got a mother that is a total wacko, now what is that going to do to that poor adolescent?
Right. I mean, just the one little thing to keep in mind, you know, that since a pre-16 child is so intimately kind of sharing mind space with the biologic parents, I mean, that child has no choice but to suffer, you know, if the parents, the biologic parents, you know, are, especially if they're willfully producing chaos in their minds, right? That child will suffer, right? Those biologic parents went to iniquity, right? Think how that the child is suffering in the midst of that, right?
But if they have their own adjuster at six.
I mean, if they've got an adjuster, obviously the adjuster will help to buffer the child from the issues of the biologic parents, right? But pre-adjuster child, they're just a helpless victim of whatever is going on in the parents' minds. Right? To some degree, right? All right, keep going there.
In due course, thought adjusters come to indwell these little ones. While the seraphic ministry to both groups of the probationary dependent orders of survival is in general similar to that of the more advanced parent, or equivalent to that of the parent in case only one survives. Those attaining the third circle, regardless of the status of their parents, are accorded personal guardians.
See, that last little bit is just reminding you of how having an adjuster, you know, not only can serve as a kind of to buffer a bit, but, you know, potentializes you, being grown ahead of your parents, right? Your parents haven't reached third circler, but you reach third circler, yeah. Right? You know, see, so that, again, that's why, you know, you can see the adjuster constitutes identity in the eyes of the universe. You see how it's giving you this child, this ability to catalyze their separation from their parents. Okay, and this thing, it's not just in this context, it's telling you how it works, not just on probationary nurseries, but in general, your kids, when they were young, what kind of angelic ministry do they have, right? Well, until they're a separate mindal self, they're just considered, like if you're in a group of 500, with your angelic ministry, they're just part of that, without increasing the count beyond 500, right? They're just considered to be attached still, right, to the 500 group, right? So, no matter how many kids, a pair might have that are younger than 16, right? So that gives you a little clue. And see, they don't explain that up in paper 113. It's here where you get that little tidbit about, well, how are little kids managed with angelic ministry? Yeah.
You know, Roger wants to know what happens to a fetus when it dies.
It doesn't matter when you die. Like we've talked about, You know, it doesn't matter where you might draw a line about some significant thing, birth or age six or whatever. The operative word about the probationary nursery is before, right? You know, and they actually bring it all the way down, even if you die before, you know, 9 months, before material birth. Right? Everyone is resurrected in a probationary nursery. And we talked about that extensively back there, the probationary nursery. Even here, children who die when too young to have thought adjusters. Yeah. A one-month-old baby in the womb is too young to have a thought adjuster, right? See, I mean, just notice the way they always word it, right? They always, you know, no matter where they draw a line, they're always talking about before, so you don't get into this mode that, you know, you think there's some... there's some beginning, you know, of potential. No, you're a potential finaliter at conception, right now. Just as much as you are right now. Right? You have value now, not because of what you are, but what you can become. Another thing to think about with value. You know, it's more what you're reaching toward than what you have. The meaning is more kind of what you have. The value is what you're reaching towards.
Similar probation nurseries are maintained on the finaliter spheres of the constellation and the universe headquarters for the adjusterless children of the primary and secondary modified orders of ascenders.
All right. Actually, let's read the next one, and I'll explain a little bit more about that when they give us a little bit more here.
4. Mortals of the secondary modified orders of ascension. These are the progressive human beings of the intermediate evolutionary worlds. As a rule, they are not immune to natural death, but they are exempt from passing through the 7 mansion worlds. The less perfected group reawaken on the headquarters of their local system, passing by only the mansion worlds. The intermediate group go to the constellation training worlds. They pass by the entire Marantia regime of the local system, still farther on in the planetary ages of spiritual striving. Many survivors awaken on the constellation headquarters, and there begin the paradise ascent. But before any of these groups may go forward, they must journey back as instructors to the worlds they missed, gaining many experiences as teachers in those realms which they passed by as a student. They all subsequently proceed to paradise by the ordained routes of mortal progression.
So especially see that last paragraph, with the last paragraph of the previous block about the probationary nursery. You know, you read about that, it's like, okay, so if I, you know, if I actually, you know, am going to be starting my ascension really, on the constellation headquarters world, like, you know, some of these they're talking about here. What if I have a child that, you know, dies because of the vicissitudes when they're 2 or something, right? Well, there's a probationary nursery up at the higher levels too. And he's going, well, yeah, but that child is not going to be ready to start their ascension on Edentia. You know, they're going to have to go back and, you know, do some work on the first mansion world, etc. And so am I just going to, you know, say goodbye to my child? No, you're going to go back too and teach. Right? See, so, you know, if you have children, you know, if you're in an advanced stage of a world where, you know, you're skipping over all the mansion worlds and everything, right? The child is going to have to go back, and you'll be going back too. So, you know, you'll stay kind of in sync with those children. Yeah, you know, relatively speaking, as they work their way up. So that's an important little thing, see, to kind of put those two together. Even if, you know, we're going to read about the next one, if you're going all the way to the local universe headquarters, you know, to start your ascension career, right? You got all the backfilling that you got to do before you really start there, right? That whole bit of teaching all the way up.
They talk about how joyful it is for the parents to hug their child,
Yeah, yeah, right, right. And they talk about the probationary nursery. Yeah, see, and that's what I was saying. I mean, you read this one about the probationary nursery is way on high, and it's like, what about that joy thing? You know, if, you know, just for a few years they're there, and then they go way back down to the first mansion world, and, you know, and you're heading off, you know, that seems like a really terrible tension, right? See, but it's not there. You know, you go back down too.
Well, I know what I'm thinking of. When they meet up with your children that they lost before
yes.
birth or
yes.
as a child.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah. Right. But, you know, it obviously doesn't stop, you know, with the probationary nursery. I mean, right. it's cool to have, you know, that closeness, like they were saying, the sentimental attachments, you know, earlier. Okay. Right, so the basics there, you know, is pretty straightforward. The other stuff there, you know, not immune to natural death, right? You know, you understand what that means. You know, that in other words, you know, everyone is not fusing, you know, on their nativity sphere. So, in general, you know, you're talking about spheres that aren't super advanced. But just because there's a sphere that's not super advanced, it could be an individual that's quite advanced, right? So, you know, you could have, long before you're deep into light and life or something, you could have individuals from worlds that, where a lot of people in that world are going to the mansion worlds, but there's a few individuals that jump all the way up to the constellation level, okay? You know, especially on a, you know, you can imagine on a world like ours where things are so spread out, you know, there's probably going to be a lot of that, you know, as this world goes forward. Well, there'll be a leading edge that will be, you know, jumping way high, but a trailing tail that'll still very much need the mansion worlds.
Okay. 5 years
okay. Ahead. On a normal world where it's the spectrum is a lot tighter, you know, you wouldn't have as many exceptions to the rule, right? But, okay. Well, yeah, we can probably do it. Let's just, yeah, get this last part in here.
Mortals of the primary modified order of ascension. These mortals belong to the adjuster-fused type of evolutionary life, but they are most often representative of the final phases of human development on an evolving world. These glorified beings are exempt from passing through the portals of death. They are submitted to sun seizure. They're translated from among the living and appear immediately in the presence of the sovereign sun on the headquarters of the local universe.
So they're just showing you how it kind of goes hand in hand. I mean, or it definitely does. I mean, if you've got someone who's going to skip over everything and start at the local universe headquarters, they're going to fuse in their mortal life, right? I mean, both of those advanced things are in play at the same time, see? Okay. And quote-unquote sun seizure, just they're pointing out that if you're you're not just fusing, but you're fusing with a very advanced nature, so that when you fuse, you directly feel that local spirit gravity focus of the Creator Sun, you know, and get drawn to the local universe headquarters by that spirit gravity, that localized spirit gravity of the Creator Sun. You know, so you've gotten up high enough that you sort of directly feel that spirit gravity. Whereas if you fuse, you know, or don't fuse, but you know, if you fuse at a lower state of a development, you won't immediately feel that spirit gravity so directly like that. That's what they're meaning by the quote-unquote sun seizure. Right? You've kind of gotten up to a very high spiritual level, so you sort of directly, you know, the very fact that spirit fragment and you are literally just pulled to the local universe headquarters, right? And that's what they're getting at. You know, right now for us, that spirit gravity is a very tenuous thing that's kind of way above where we are, you know, so we don't really feel it in any sort of direct way, the way your feet are being pulled down to the floor, you know, by material gravity. Yeah. Okay.
These are the mortals who fuse with their adjusters during mortal life, and such adjuster-fused personalities traverse space freely before being clothed with Marantia forms. These fused souls go by direct adjuster transit to the resurrection halls of the higher Marantia spheres, where they receive their initial Marantia investiture, just as do all other mortals arriving from the evolutionary worlds.
See how they're using this as an opportunity to talk more general than just primary modified. I mean, no matter who fuses, right? That's the way it works, right? I mean, you don't have to be no soul has to be transported. It just rides along with the adjuster, and to the wherever you're going to be resurrected. See, because they didn't just say local universe headquarters. They said higher Marantia spheres, right? Wherever the heck, you might be going to the first mansion world if you fused. But you won't have to be transported. The adjuster just takes the soul to the first mansion world.
Is this the only place where they mention adjuster transit?
I don't know if that's the only plot they have those direct words.
Implies the adjuster has the capacity.
I'm trying to remember. I think there might be at least one other time when they speak kind of directly about this issue of the adjuster taking you there. Maybe up in paper 112 or 113, I can't remember.
This primary modified order of mortal ascension may apply to individuals in any of the planetary series, from the lowest to the highest stages of the adjuster fusion worlds. But it more frequently functions on the older of these spheres after they have received the benefits of numerous sojourns of the divine suns.
There's just reminding you, like I said, of that, there's a definitive individual element here. The world at large, could be a long ways away from this sort of a state. There could be a very precocious, exemplary individual, that literally does this, when most of their fellows are not even remotely skipping over the whole local universe ascension, like that individual is. And notice they said lowest to highest. I mean, they just, because there isn't some fundamental limit. In relationship with God, all things are possible, sort of, that sort of thing. I mean, the sky's the limit. You could have an individual that, when the rest of the world is relatively limited, that, is in this advanced stage.
Okay. With the establishment of the planetary era of light and life, many go to the universe Marantia worlds by the primary modified order of translation. Further along in the advanced stages of settled existence, when the majority of the mortals leaving a realm are embraced in this class, the planet is regarded as belonging to this series. Natural death becomes decreasingly frequent on these spheres long settled in light and life. Presented by Melchizedek of the Gerasim School of Planetary Administration.
Okay, it's kind of a fun little...
How humiliating to die on one of these worlds. He died.
For those on the webinar, he's imagining a person that actually dies on one of these worlds when everyone else is fusing. If you're the kind of person that would make fun of that, you don't exist on one of those worlds. Anyway, I was about to say there, it's kind of a fun byline there with the Melchizedek, where they give you all the details. They don't often give you a bunch of details about Melchizedek when he's an author like that. Gerasim School of Planetary Administration. That little bit, like I was saying, see that you can, you can get to the point where, these categories that we've been just talking about, are not just thought of as an individual issue, but more of a planetary label. Right. And that brings you back. Remember, we are in that context. We were talking about everyone on this planet you know, is a low gravity being, or, you know, right? So they're reminding you that even though this all in some ways sounds kind of individual and not planet-wide, there is that element here as well. So just, you know, so they wanted to kind of wrap that up as sort of a final thing that they're saying there. You know, and the same is true, remember, with worlds at large. You know, a world can be advancing a lot, but there's also a whole local system advancing, right? Or a whole constellation advancing, right? And eventually, you know, you don't just have a few worlds that are super advanced. Eventually, you'll have every world in that whole local system that's very advanced, and every world in that constellation, right? So there's a number of things like that. Keep that in mind, that you have an individual phenomenon and a collective phenomenon often in play, like the functioning of the adjutants. The adjutants function in an individual mode, but they also function in a collective mode. That's just another expression of what we just read here. Yeah. You have these sort of general patterns that manifest in all kinds of different areas, and the more you see them in a few areas, the more you'll recognize them in other areas where it hadn't dawned on you, like, say, with the adjutants. You know, that the adjutant, the fifth adjutant, doesn't just function individually, it also functions collectively. And you can look for its collective functioning as well as its individual functioning. Yeah. All right, so notice that in the process of giving you these little thumbnail sketches, if you're thinking about it, reflecting, they use the opportunity to say some things that they don't say other places, seed some recognition of some more generalized patterns. They're always trying to do that. If it's in a mode where it might be kind of boilerplate, sort of just innately what the subject matter is, but the book is not a revelation of fact, it's a revelation of truth. So there are, just, you know, you can see here how they've tried to make sure that that was the case by giving you much more than just the immediate facts, constantly saying things that generalize or connect you to other places in the book or whatnot. Yeah. You want to always be in that mode when you're engaging the revelation. And places like this can kind of teach you that technique, because it's sort of fairly immediately obvious, you know, as you start thinking about this, that it's like that.
Well, what struck me the most in this last sections is about parenting, because I have a tendency to think of parenting as something we do when we're young and dumb. Mm-hmm. But here are these people that are translating on the constellations, or even the...
Even higher.
Who have children in the probationary nursery, who have a relationship with those children, who are have a very rudimentary beginning, just like we all do.
Yep. Yeah.
And yet it's not without meaning. I mean,
Remember, it's one of those things that you can't get anywhere without that experience. Mm-hmm. You know, that fundamental relationship of you, the mature, to them, the immature, right? I mean, you know, how big a differential is there between your divine parents and you, right? And you're getting an initial relationship to that great fact. You know, it's unfortunate that some parents are little different than their children. The extent, you know, maybe they have 10 children here, but they aren't really that higher in nature than their children. That means they're going to have to do the whole parenting thing in the mansion world and stuff, because they didn't get the essence of it. You know, it's not an issue of numbers merely, right? There has to be some truth of a differential where you're above and they're below, and you reach down to where they are and help them as they need at that lowly level. But with not just the immediacy of that level in mind, right? You're helping at that level so that they can eventually get up to your level, right? You help them as a means to a greater end, not as an end in itself. And parents that want to just, you know, be another kid, you know, with their kids, see, are short-circuiting that. Right? They're just helping them as an end in itself. Yep, good thought. All right, well, we'll head into planetary princes next time. And, you know, we've got quite a bit of stuff here yet on the individual world level to go through. So, we'll take it up next time. Let's take a moment here.